Hey there, it's Joshua. Just a quick note before we start the show. A lot of news has broken today and is still breaking. The Friday News Roundup, of course, was recorded earlier, so we discussed a lot of what's been happening, but not everything. So to stay up to date on the very latest, you should keep an ear out on your NPR member station or go online to npr.org. Thanks. This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington, where winter is not just coming, it's here. In the new Congress, Nancy Pelosi reclaimed her Iron Throne for the second time, 12 years after she became the first woman to rule the House. Fighting at her side is a Democratic freshman class with a record number of female, minority, and LGBTQ lawmakers. Their first mission? Get everything running again and end a partial shutdown that's lasted for 2 weeks. Meanwhile, President Trump continues to demand his wall and billions to fund it. His Instagram page now has a poster inspired by Game of Thrones that reads, "The wall is coming." Fans of the show may see the problem with that reference to border security, because on the show, the wall fails to keep out the intruders it was built to repel. This week, he brought a similar poster to his first cabinet meeting of the year that read, "Sanctions are coming." When he had first shared that image before the midterms, HBO tweeted, quote, "How do you say trademark misuse in Dothraki?" Unquote. This week's news is not nearly as complex as Game of Thrones, but there is still plenty to discuss. And joining us in studio to help with that is Franco Ordonez, the White House correspondent for McClatchy's Washington Bureau. Franco, welcome to the Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us in studio is Laura Barrón-López, a national reporter for Politico. Laura, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
And Aswin Soobsang is a White House reporter for The Daily Beast. Swin, glad you're here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about the government shutdown. Of course, on Wednesday, President Trump met with Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer to discuss a solution to the shutdown. It's now in its 14th day. Franco Ordonez, how did those talks go? Are they moving anything forward?
Both sides are definitely, are digging their heels in. Neither seems to be budging, or at least publicly, they are not budging. They're both holding the line. Nancy Pelosi yesterday was clearly saying absolutely no wall, no wall. And Trump, trotted out members of ICE and the Border Patrol at a briefing, or some would say just a, public relations talk in front of the press briefing room yesterday at the White House without not taking any questions. That said, some Republicans are kind of seeming to hedge. A few voted with House Democrats to reopen the government without wall funding. Certainly in the statements, even President Trump himself seems to be open to negotiating a wall or at least the $5 billion. He seems to be budging a little bit.
Now, the vote that you were referring to where some Republicans voted with Democrats, that's a vote that took place this week. And Laura, we should note that the president has said this in the past about the wall. This is part of what he said less than a month ago when he was speaking to Pelosi and Schumer.
I'll take it. Okay, good. You know what I'll say? Yes. If we don't get what we want one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay,
absolutely.
Fair enough.
And
we
I am
disagree.
Proud, and I'll
we
tell
disagree.
You what, I am proud to shut down the government for border security, Chuck.
Part of what the president said to Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi less than a month ago. Now the president, Laura, has been trying to kind of shift blame to Democrats for a shutdown he initially said that he wanted. Mm-hmm. Is there any sign of what's going to break this logjam? What's going to end this standoff?
Well, I know that they are going to be meeting again today, so maybe we'll see some signs out of the meeting that Democrats, the Democratic leaders, Pelosi, Hoyer, have with Trump, which should be about midday. But so far, it doesn't look like there is anything that will break this logjam. Yesterday, as Frank mentioned, House Democrats pushed through two bills, one that would reopen most of the government. It's a clean CR that would go through September. The next one also would fund DHS through February 8th.
A CR, a continuing resolution.
A continuing resolution through February 8th. And five Republicans voted for the DHS one, and seven Republicans joined Democrats and voted for the one that would reopen most of the government through September. And so what we see from Pelosi right now is a pressure campaign. She's trying to show that there's a new sheriff in town in the House, and she's going to be pushing through these bills because she's able to keep her Democratic caucus together and then put the pressure on McConnell and say, the ball is in your court. You're either going to pass these the way you did in December. They passed a clean continuing resolution, or you're just going to continue to not do anything.
Yes, when I was going to ask you about the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and kind of his role in all this, where do they stand on this? Is there a point at which the Republicans maybe decide to circumvent the president and say, look, this shutdown's been going on long enough, we're not gaining any political mileage from this, we have to reopen the government? Where are the Republicans on this right now?
Well, the Democrats are certainly hoping on, or at least betting on, that that comes sooner rather than later. But at least for the time being, the four-word phrase that I hear most commonly and most frequently among my sources, both in the administration and on Capitol Hill, is no end in sight. If only for the fact that at this moment in time, and for the past roughly 2 weeks, there just is no incentive for either the Democrat side or the Trump or Republican side to break this standoff. Like, they are both giving exactly what their political bases and, quite frankly, their political parties want on this issue. And there's just nothing to gain from either of them to blink in this game of chicken at this point. And part of that is because the pain that would be inflicted by a government shutdown that lasts many weeks, it's only been 2 weeks so far. Yes, there are hundreds of thousands of furloughed workers. The White House recently told me this week that they have come out for back pay. So at least they're giving them that, like, sort of winking promise. But for the time being, beyond that, in terms of things that move votes, both in terms of the electorate and on Capitol Hill, nothing has really changed to panic anybody, at least to no visceral, highly noticeable degree at this point.
Franco?
I'd agree that nothing so far has changed, and certainly each side is speaking directly to their base. Both sides don't necessarily have an incentive to speak. Obviously, Trump's base wants him to fulfill his signature campaign promise. Also, the Democrats, it's a different Democratic Party. They are definitely emboldened. In the past, they may have been open to a Dreamers for Wall deal. Not anymore. They want to take a stand here. And obviously, we have 2020 to look ahead to. But let's be real here. I mean, now is the time to be real. And TSA agents are some of those individuals who are having to work without pay. And many of them, about 50% of them, make less than $40,000 a year. How long can they last? And if people are impacted at the airports, I think we may have a change.
And we heard from one TSA agent who wrote that some agents have to drive 40, 50, or 70 miles to the airport that they're based at just because of cost of living issues. We've also heard from a number of you who left voicemails for us. Here is what Renee left in our inbox.
This shutdown has affected me and my family because I work for DHS, Department of Homeland Security, and I don't know when my next paycheck is going to be here. I don't know how I'm going to sell this to my landlord or my bill collectors, any bills that I owe or have to pay. So every penny counts, every dime counts. It's been very stressful, and I've also been looking for another job to ultimately replace working for the government. It's just ridiculous that we all have to be stressed out and worried about if we're going to get paid or not.
Laura, in terms of what might move this forward, it's also worth noting that there is a lawsuit that was filed against the Trump administration on Monday by the largest employee union for federal workers, the American Federation of Government Employees. Is there any sense that some kind of outside pressure, like a lawsuit, might move this forward? Or does this really have to kind of come from Congress?
I think it's going to come from Congress. But again, that applies another element of pressure to Trump on top of the new Democratic House. And so you can tell that he's starting to feel a bit cornered. I mean, the fact that he did have his first press briefing, I'm pretty positive, ever at the press room in the White House. That's the first time in 2 years that he has gone to that podium and has spoken to the press directly. And he decided to do it on the first day of the new Congress because Nancy Pelosi was dominating headlines. The new Democratic House was dominating headlines, and they said right out of the gate, we are going to take votes to reopen the government. So all of that renewed pressure on him, we could maybe ultimately see him caving. We have seen from Lindsey Graham, one of his allies in the Senate, as well as in the outgoing interview by John Kelly, his former chief of staff, this effort to try to explain that the wall isn't actually a wall, it's border security, to place more blame on Democrats that way. But it doesn't really work, because Democrats for a long time have been saying, we're totally fine with giving more money to border security.
Right.
It's this concrete wall that Trump continually tweets about that we are not okay with funding.
Laura wrote on our Facebook page, the shutdown is holding the hardworking government hostage to Trump's wall. My husband is furloughed and my son works for a government contractor. I worry for both and especially for my son. And as we consider our political divisions, let's remember what keeps us together. Love. The captain and Tennille told us so. The captain, Daryl Dragon, made surf rock with the Beach Boys before finding success on the pop charts alongside his wife, Toni Tennille, in the 70s. Daryl Dragon died this week at the age of 76. Now, he and Tennille divorced in 2014, but she was at his side when he passed. Before we move on, let me get to some of your comments about the government shutdown. Mark wrote on our Facebook page, the real problem for us is that I'm a contractor for the government. We're not getting paid, nor will we get back pay like our government employees. It's very frustrating and disheartening through this period. Swin, I think it was you who mentioned that the White House has signaled a willingness to make sure that the government workers get back pay, which is not uncommon for shutdowns.
Correct.
I think that happened in 2013. What about people whose livelihoods kind of depend on the federal government? There's no effort to try to make them whole at this point, at least not that I've heard of.
No, not at the moment.
Right. So they will just kind of have to bear the cost of this. One of the other interesting aspects of this, Franco, that has struck me is how the shutdown has all of these ripple effects that some local communities have started to deal with, like trash collection. You know, this trash piling up on the National Mall because the Smithsonian's closed, and so D.C.'s government's like, fine, we'll pick up the trash. There's trash piling up at Land's End and parts of the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, which is the largest recreation area in the park system, and the city of San Francisco is like, fine, we'll pick up the trash. So it feels like the shutdown has kind of evolved in the consciousness of the country as more people are literally being required to pick up the mess.
Exactly. I mean, it's starting to get real. I mean, people are starting to pick up. I mean, this, sadly, shutdowns have become a course of business in Washington. It's one of those many things that American voters just are frustrated about Washington. It's a sign that Washington doesn't work, that the people, that the elitists, quote unquote, in the Beltway are not really concerned about what is happening to real Americans. Well, now real Americans across the country, not just in Washington, are being impacted. You mentioned trash collection, you know, trash in parks, national parks across the country. We talked about TSA agents. They're going to be impacting flyers. So these are real things. And these are real things that now the grassroots are going to start letting their members of Congress know. And that's where I think we could see some changes.
I have never seen people en masse being so nice to TSA agents as I did over the holiday break. Like, everybody was just patient. They were quiet. They were, okay, I'll take off my shoes. Thank you very much, TSA agent. Best of luck to you. I hope you've got good savings in the bank. Like, everybody was very cool. Not that you should be mean to TSA on a regular basis, but this time they were especially nice. With regards to the way the business is done in D.C., Jude tweeted, someone should introduce a law that deducts shutdown days from everyone's taxes. We'd see a lot fewer shutdowns, and I don't feel like paying a government that's not working. Worth noting that this government is just now getting to work this week. The 116th Congress was sworn in yesterday, and this incoming class in the House is being considered, and it is, in fact, one of the most diverse in the history of our republic. The Congressional Black Caucus swore in 55 new members, and that's the largest incoming class it's ever had. Laura, we know that the Democrats have to deal with the shutdown. That's kind of job one. What are some of the other big items on the Democratic agenda that the party has put forward as their big goals for the next few years?
Well, right off the bat, they're going to be working on a slew of bills that are going to target campaign finance, are going to target voter suppression. I was talking to Representative Elijah Cummings yesterday, and he was saying that he may want to bring in the governor of Georgia, Kemp, to talk about what went on there over during the governor's race and reports of voter suppression. He wants to look at other instances in Kansas and also possibly North Carolina of the election fraud allegations. And so you're going to see Democrats really make a push on focusing on the Voting Rights Act and taking a look at all these instances of voter suppression. They also want to tackle climate change more than Republicans ever did. So right already, I think it was yesterday, it was definitely this week, the new chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee said that his first hearing is going to be on the impacts of climate change and what Democrats can possibly do to combat that. We've seen from the incoming class a big push for this Green New Deal. So there is definitely going to be pressure from the new members on the more established Democrats to keep this ball moving.
Are we talking like kind of a Paris Agreement successor deal? Is that kind of what they're thinking
Well, they kind of are trying to model it after the New Deal. So it would be something that incorporates the jobs elements. So trying to make sure that it's an all-encompassing package to combat climate change as opposed to as opposed to something like the Paris Agreement, which just looked at reducing the emissions
right.
By a set date.
And Swin, it's interesting that, you know, Laura mentioned Elijah Cummings, the new incoming chair mm-hmm. of the House Oversight Committee, which is this big kind of investigative arm of the House. I wonder what our sense is of what these new committee chairs are going to be focused on. We spoke to Adam Schiff here yesterday, who's the incoming chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and he's not shy about saying, yeah, this administration needs to be investigated. They may well be a threat to the country, and we are going to use our authority to do what we're supposed to be doing. Elijah Cummings has been a little more hesitant, saying that, you know, he's not going to be handing out subpoenas like party favors, but these committee chairmanships do matter.
The Trump administration and Trump world at large is a particularly target-rich environment when it comes to handing out subpoenas or launching investigations. So the Democratic Party is not going to be particularly in want or deprived of vast wealth. For those sorts of things. And talking to people within the White House over the past several weeks and months, many of them have told me that they expect to spend much more time in the coming year testifying on Capitol Hill or producing or going over episodes where they have to produce documents for investigators on the Hill. So, yeah, this is certainly ramping up.
Laura?
Well, I will just say, you know, another aspect that will probably dominate some of the news is this push for impeachment by certain new members, even some members that have been there for a while already. Al Green of Texas and Brad Sherman of California are trying to bring forward a bill, articles of impeachment. But again, going back to Representative Cummings, who is the oversight chairman, he yesterday also told me that is still premature, that Democrats need to wait for the Mueller report. And on top of that, if they were to try to pursue impeachment right now, it would not be a bipartisan effort. And you want it to be a bipartisan effort, so that way it doesn't look like political grandstanding by Democrats. Cummings also brought up, you know, the Bill Clinton impeachment saga and how that hurt Republicans, and that it could also hurt Democrats if they try to pursue this. It could hurt them in 2020 if they right. try to pursue this.
Well, and at a certain point, just because of the way that impeachment is set up, like the House can just move articles of impeachment. Democrats could do that on their own. The Senate, you need 2/3. So mm-hmm. it kind of makes sense just logistically to get that in line. Although I do hear you in terms of some members being very kind of bullish on impeachment. Rashida Tlaib, who is the first member of Congress of Palestinian descent, was sworn into office this week. That she at an event said, you know, recounted a story of her talking to her child about becoming a new member of Congress. And she said, "We're going to go in there and impeach the blank," and referred to the president using a very strong Samuel L. Jackson-esque expletive. Franco?
It's very interesting because my sources, you know, close to the White House are, you know, love that kind of talk.
And everybody knew what I meant when I said Samuel L. Jackson. Okay, go ahead.
They love that kind of talk. They love, because they really feel that Democrats risk overreach is, you know, kind of that, you know, quote unquote word that Democrats that are afraid of, and Republicans, many of whom are kind of excited, maybe excited is maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but certainly they see opportunities here. My sources certainly tell me that if the Democrats try to impeach, that would only help President Trump in gaining, you know, support from his base and also likely from mainstream Americans.
Swin?
Well, another interesting factor about this incoming Democratic class, particularly the younger attention-grabbing new members, is that the energy in what they are doing and what they're espousing isn't strictly to hell with Donald Trump. They are very much taking, making a target of how the Democratic Party has decided to organize itself over the past many years and several decades, whether you see it in their policy prescriptions for things like the Green New Deal and other elements of climate change, Medicare for All, how to take on or potentially abolish ICE. These are maximalist demands where the point is not to say Donald Trump is the problem, but in many ways the Democratic Party in its current, as they may label it, neoliberal mold, is as much of a problem, or at least a symptom of the same problem.
Before we move on from this, Laura, it's also just worth noting the optics of this week were really kind of moving to watch this huge class of women ascending the steps of the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And, Deb Haaland of New Mexico, I believe it was, who's a Pueblo Indian, was wearing her traditional Pueblo garb when she took the oath. Kyrsten Sinema, who's the first openly bisexual member of Congress, took the oath. So Congress is more LGBT than ever before. We mentioned how the Congressional Black Caucus has more members. This lots of families and children and, you know, people dressing up in one another's, I believe with Rashida Tlaib swearing in, there were other members who also wore Palestinian cultural garb to support her.
Right.
This was one of those rare moving moments in Washington where the augustness of just being a federal lawmaker felt like something noble. I don't know that I've heard Congress say that about itself in a long time.
Well, the just being there and watching it all, and I was there yesterday, it was striking to see the number of women that were sworn in. There were 100 total in the House, I believe. I don't think that included the Senate. New female lawmakers that were sworn in. And you saw them there with their families, their husbands, their kids. And Abigail Spanberger was saying that she was just trying to soak it all in and make sure that her daughters were just really were in the moment. And you saw them on the House floor, and they were able to witness again Nancy Pelosi making history by being sworn in as the Speaker of the House for the second time. She's the first to have like an 8-year stint in of being in the minority in between her speakerships, and she's only the second to reclaim the Speaker's gavel a second time.
Sam Rayburn was the first, I think.
Yes.
Let's shift gears now and talk about some names that have come up with regards to the 2020 elections in one way or another, starting with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. A number of women who worked with him on his 2016 campaign say that they experienced sexual harassment and disparities in pay. Senator Sanders discussed it with CNN's Anderson Cooper and says he did not know about it at the time.
When I ran for re-election in 2018 in Vermont, we put forward the strongest set of principles in terms of mandatory training, in terms of women, if they felt harassed, having an independent firm that they can go to. And I think that's kind of, you know, the gold standard for what we should be doing. So I certainly apologize to any woman who felt that she was not treated appropriately. And of course, if I run, we will do better next time.
Senator Bernie Sanders speaking to CNN's Anderson Cooper. Franco Ordonez, is there any early sense of how likely this might be to impact his presidential run? People seem to think it's very likely that he'll try again.
I mean, it certainly seems very likely that he's going to try to run again. He certainly seems to be giving those indications, and this kind of news just cannot help. I mean, it in today's day, in the Me Too movement, for these type of allegations to come against a campaign of someone who really was kind of the spark of the progressive movement in 2016. This is really tough. And he's talking about some of these, things that they had did to kind of be out there. But for a campaign to put in kind of a hotline for people who feel like they have been harassed or had their rights questioned, I think it speaks to how significant these were. I mean, this was like more than a dozen staffers who put their name down on this letter. That's serious.
And of course, you're right. Bernie Sanders certainly has continued to have impacts on the Democratic Party, changed the way that the party deals with superdelegates at their summer meeting last year. He certainly certainly is a potential contender. And by the way, I should just note, nobody is accusing Senator Sanders of having done anything. This is things that happened in the campaign, but not by his hand. Is that right?
Correct.
All right. The other, go ahead, Swin.
I mean, the sad reality about any presidential campaign is that, look, any reporter who's ever covered virtually any presidential campaign in modern American history knows that sexual misconduct and sexual harassment, particularly with these sort of powerful, entitled men running the show, is way more rampant than it should be. This is not to excuse anything. It's good that this conversation is being had and that these women put their name to this letter and that Senator Sanders is made to answer for this. But it, to me, it goes towards a broader problem, not about Sanders' 2016 campaign or Senator Sanders himself, but the culture of men in power, including on political campaigns where sexual misconduct is sort of given a pass and a breeding ground. And post-Me Too movement, hopefully that has changed dramatically. We shall see.
Laura?
I will say, you know, Sanders, a part of his answer, I'm not sure if it was in that clip that you ran, but he did say, look, you know, I was busy. He kind of tried to excuse himself by saying, look, I was busy running a national campaign, which I know did not, which didn't actually go well for him amongst the progressive crowd. There were a number of progressives that took to Twitter to say that they think he needs to issue an even greater apology, given the way he initially came out after the report. And it's something that, yes, we just noted, it is something that is rampant on a number of campaigns, but Sanders is going to have to answer for this soon.
Interesting to get some of your comments on what you want from the Democratic field. Texas Baroness tweeted, so here's a thought. Everyone running for president in the Democratic Party should get together and decide before they split the vote so very badly that we wind up with the current in office again. One of the main contenders folks will have to consider is Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. She definitely has her eye on 2020.
No matter what our differences, most of us want the same thing, to be able to work hard, play by the same set of rules, and take care of the people we love. That's the America I'm fighting for. And that's why today I'm launching an exploratory committee for president. But the outcome of this election will depend on you.
So, Elizabeth Warren, she officially announced that she will be running for president in 2020. I think this came as a surprise, Franco, to absolutely nobody, because she's been kind of laying the groundwork from here. What's been the reaction to this, particularly to her being the first one to formally say in a full-throated way, essentially, I want to unseat Donald Trump?
It's been very interesting to watch the reaction. I think starting off, you know, she made her announcement on New Year's Eve, you know, at a moment that many people were very curious about. Timing was when, you know, not much was attention was on the news. That said, she also created a lot of space for her so that all the media outlets, everyone was talking about her. And there was a lot of feeling that she was perhaps, you know, trying to give herself some space to get her own messages out. You played the clip of some of those issues that were very important to her, and perhaps maybe distance her herself from some of the questions that have been raised when she, you know, kind of did those tests to kind of prove her lineage to Native American history. I think people are very interested, as you point out there, definitely no question that she's going to run, but they're also curious whether she missed her opportunity in 2016, and does she represent the current Democratic Party?
Much more we got to discuss in the roundup. We talked more about Elizabeth Warren in yesterday's program, but we should also note current Senator Mitt Romney, former Utah governor. He is now in Congress. This week, the Washington Post published an article by Senator Romney in which he criticized President Trump. Among other things, he wrote, quote, his conduct over the past 2 years, particularly his actions last month, is evidence that the president has not risen to the mantle of the office, unquote. Now, Swin, we know that Mitt Romney ain't a fan of President Trump. Like, this is nothing new. He's not
on and off.
On and off, right. He hasn't been a steady supporter of the president. So what impact does this have? I've heard some people kind of extrapolating about what this means for the Republican Party writ large. I don't know if that's a fair extrapolation.
Mitt Romney really wants to have it. Senator Romney now. really wants to have it both ways on this. If there is a gigantic Trump-shaped implosion, he wants to be one of the top players there to pick up the pieces. That seems to be all the indicators he's been hurling out with stuff like this, including the op-ed. But as he noted in the Washington Post op-ed and in a subsequent interview, I believe on CNN later that same day, or the following day, I should say, he underscores several times that actually between me and Trump and his administration, there are a lot of policy intersections between the two of us. And in fact, there are a lot of things that Mitt Romney has explicitly applauded Trump on when it comes to policy, especially the tax cuts and other things in the forms of domestic and foreign policy. So I would be really surprised if we even get a Senator Romney who rises to the form of someone like Jeff Flake.
Yeah.
I think his criticism will be far more muted than a lot of people on the anti-Trump right, of which compared to the pro-Trump right, there are very, 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 very vanishingly few would like to see from him. And I think you're going to continue to see a form of Mitt Romney of one have it both ways, which quite frankly fits with the vast majority of his political career.
And we should remember even that the Jeff Flakes and the Bob Corkers of the Senate may have been vocally opposing the president, but when it came down to voting and to policy, it was a different story. They were vocal, but they were still kind of within the GOP mainline.
They all don't like how mean Trump can be and how frenetic he can be on Twitter. But when it comes to upwards of 90% of Republican policy, they're on board.
One more story we should get to, Laura, this empty seat in the House from North Carolina's 9th district. Initially, that race had been called for the Republican, Mark Harris. Now it's undecided because of an elections fraud investigation. North Carolina's Board of Elections has been dissolved. An interim board will be appointed by the governor. Laura, what is going on in North Carolina?
Well, actually, there isn't going to be an interim board. So what happened is the board was dissolved. The governor did try to put in an interim board, but realized the North Carolina GOP wasn't going to play ball because the Republican Party has to appoint certain members to that board. They said they weren't going to do it. So now a hearing that was supposed to be held on January 11th, an evidentiary hearing by the election board, is no longer happening. It's been indefinitely postponed. A new board, according to a law that was passed in December by the state legislature, won't even be formed until the end of this month, January 31st. So we could not see a hearing by the board until sometime in February. So right now, Mark Harris, the Republican who appeared to win the election on November 6th, on election night, but the results were never certified, he has filed a legal challenge asking a state judge to certify the election results so that way he can be seated. House Democrats are not going to be okay with that. They are going to, by all of my reporting and the members that I have spoken to, refuse to seat him, and then that can trigger an investigation in the House.
We should move on and talk about the president's cabinet changes before our time is up. But thanks to those of you who sent us some of your stories of attending swearings in this week. Faisal tweeted, attended Ilhan Omar swearing in. As a Somali American, it was a very hopeful moment and just shows how civically engaged the community has gotten in Minnesota and other areas. Pat tweeted, on New Year's Day, I attended the swearing-in of the all-new judges and officials in Harris County, Texas. That's where Houston is. 80 judges. 18 are black women. All are Democrats. The formerly all-GOP county commissioners are now majority Democratic, as are the row offices. I'm so proud. And Kilted Rogue tweeted, I applaud Senator Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, declining to swear her oath upon a Bible, choosing instead a law book with the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution states plainly that no religious test shall ever be required for any office or public trust of the United States. By the way, I think we said earlier that Mitt Romney was the governor of Utah. Everybody out there playing the home game knows it's Massachusetts. First, I'm allowed one mistake a year, and clearly I just cashed in. Let's talk about the president's cabinet. You know that General Jim Mattis has officially left the Pentagon as Secretary of Defense. President Trump now is essentially calling that a firing.
What's he done for me? How has he done in Afghanistan? Not too good. Not too good. I'm not happy with what he's done in Afghanistan, and I shouldn't be happy. But he was very happy. He was very thankful when I got him $700 billion, and then the following year, $716 billion. So, I mean, I wish him well. I hope he does well.
But as you know, President Obama fired him, and essentially so did I.
That was President Trump speaking to reporters on Wednesday. And that $700 billion he was referring to is the Department of Defense's budget for fiscal year 2018. That, of course, drew some strong criticism from a number of generals, including Stanley McChrystal, who recently said the president, in his words, does not tell the truth. General David Petraeus has said that he will not work for President Trump. And now Patrick Shanahan has taken over as the acting defense secretary. Also, Ryan Zinke is officially out as Interior Secretary amid 18 federal investigations into his conduct. Those range from allegations that he blocked a casino project for some lobbyists to multiple allegations that he violated the Hatch Act, which is a federal law that prohibits some members in the executive branch from engaging in certain forms of political activity. David Bernhardt has taken over as Interior Secretary. Franco, where do all these movements, plus the Chief of Staff John Kelly being gone, where does all of this leave us?
I mean, it's really fascinating. I mean, what some of my sources close to the White House tell me is, like, this is being seen as kind of an end of an era. You know, Trump used to talk about his generals and talked about them so applaudatory and, you know, always praised them and also, you know, put them out there to kind of represent him and his love for the military. Now he's tweeting about failed generals. It's really a turn of events. And those who I speak to are very concerned that the individuals who were in leadership positions in the administration, who had kind of nonpartisan roles, are now being replaced by people who are partisan and who are ideologues.
I want to come back to you, Franco, in a second and talk sports. But before we do, Swin, we should also note that there were a number of people coming in this week. The Senate approved 77 of the president's nominations this week, mostly to executive branch positions, ambassadorships, a new drug czar, a new head of the Census Bureau, a new White House science advisor. Any highlights among the new incomers? Anything we should know about them?
No, not in particular. But the funny thing about this is the thing that weighs most heavily on the president's mind right now, according to people close to him who I've spoken to over the last couple of weeks, has nothing to do with the new people coming in. It has everything to do with all the people you described earlier and then some who are going out. In fact, one of the things that almost keeps the president up at night is his fear of people who used to work for him, people who used to be close allies of his, turning on him. In fact, every time he hears about a new book coming out written by a former top lieutenant or aide or advisor, for instance, former National Security Advisor to Trump, H.R. McMaster, is coming out with a new book relatively soon. Whenever he catches wind of this, he starts asking advisors and aides close to him, what's going on with this? Do you think we've lost this person? And it's clearly something that he obsesses over, especially in terms of media consumption. The problem is he does a horrible job of not treating people, including loyalists to him, very, very shabbily. It's almost pathological that he can't seem to fix this kind of easily fixable problem. If you want fewer people to come out against you who used to work in your administration at the top ranks, just be a little bit nicer to them.
Let's talk sports before our time is up, including something that the Trump administration has done. And Franco, I'm coming back to you for this. The administration has made a play to block a deal between Major League Baseball and the Cuban Baseball Federation. There was a ruling from the Obama era that said the Cuban government does not operate the Cuban team. And because of that, Cuban players are allowed to play in the major leagues. Now, Senator Marco Rubio, who is a Republican from Florida and very strongly connected with the Cuban exile community, lambasted the deal and said, quote, "This terrible one-sided agreement will only enrich the regime and further exploit the Cuban people," unquote. So, Franco, how does President Trump factor into this now?
Well, essentially what the Trump administration is trying to do and looking into very closely is whether they can reverse that decision that you noted that Obama did back in 2016 that kind of created this space.
I'm sorry, we should clarify. When we say decision, are we talking about an executive order, a court ruling? Like, what is this?
So essentially what he created was a ruling. It wasn't a court ruling, but they have a list of entities that the United States and businesses in the United States that can do business with with entities in Cuba, you know, certain ones get variances in order to do that. Take the cruise ships, the hotels, they are allowed to do business with U.S. businesses in a way get around, circumvent the embargo, the U.S. embargo on Cuba. So what the Trump administration is doing, or what MLB wants to do, is kind of to keep that same variance, to allow them to enter into this deal with the Cuban baseball league in order to prevent so that Cuban baseball players no longer have to risk their lives to come here to the United States in order to defect. There's just so many horror stories about Cuban baseball players, you know, contracting with human smugglers, traffickers to get here in really dangerous situations. On the other hand, the administration feels like this is only going to the only people that are going to profit is the Cuban government, and they're against that.
Also this week in sports, you may have noticed that a historic tennis doubles match took place on New Year's Day. Roger Federer and Serena Williams went toe-to-toe alongside their doubles partners in the Australian Hopman Cup. It was reminiscent of that 1973 match, the Battle of the Sexes, Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs. Federer won the match alongside his partner Belinda Bencic, but that seemed kind of beside the point for fans just watching Serena and Roger Federer play. Also, Franco, there was a pretty big, let's say, a culling in the NFL this week. Six coaches were fired in one postseason week. It's par for the course, an unusually high number.
It is a bad look for diversity today in the NFL. There's no question. I think I was reading from some former NFL players that back in 2006, when Commissioner Goodell was hired, they had 7 minority coaches and 4 minority general managers. Now they have 3 head coaches and 1 minority GM. It is a bad time for diversity. This has always been an issue for the NFL, but this scenario right here really causes some concern about in a league that is about 70% African-American.
And bears directly on things like the Rooney Rule that require the NFL to actively recruit executives of color.
Absolutely.
One more fun story we found, because we don't do enough pet stories on this program. We like ending with things that are cute and fluffy. And we found a cute, fluffy story out of California. It passed a law effective this month. All kinds of new laws come in at the new year, of course. But California now requires all pet stores to only sell dogs, cats, and rabbits from shelters or from rescue organizations. The intention is to tackle the problem of unmonitored breeding mills, puppy mills, and so on. This makes California the very first state with a law like this, but other states may just follow suit. Sounds like a good idea, trying to do something about puppy mills.
That's true. I mean, I think that I actually have a rescue dog myself, and there are... you know, every time I've been to a shelter, there are a number of dogs just there that are never adopted or waiting to be adopted. And so this encourages people to go that route as opposed to buying puppies or very specific breeds that cost a large amount of money.
So. Laura Barrón-López, national political reporter with Politico. Laura, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Aswin Subsang, White House reporter for The Daily Beast. Thanks, Wynn.
Anytime.
And Franco Ordonez, White House correspondent with McClatchy's Washington Bureau. Thanks, Franco.
Thank you.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah.
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
A quick note before we get back to our conversation to those of you listening in Southern California. You can come see us live as part of an event with KPCC. We'll be talking about the complicated relationship between California and the rest of the country, from politics to the economy, innovation, immigration, and more. The event takes place at the Skirball Cultural Center in LA on Tuesday, January 15th. You can get your tickets online at kpcc.org/in-person. The world celebrated the new year with fireworks, music, hugs, kisses, and some resolutions, all in hopes of a fresh start. But there is a lot of unfinished business from 2018 that will shape this new year in foreign policy, politics, and the global economy. Here to help us understand the first week of news in 2019 is Indira Lakshmanan, the executive editor at the Pulitzer Center and a Washington columnist for the Boston Globe. Indira, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. We also wish a happy new year to Christian Carlson, Carl, the editor of Democracy Post at The Washington Post and a contributing editor with Foreign Policy. He is the author of Strange Rebels, 1979 and the Birth of the 21st Century. Christian, welcome.
Thank you.
And joining us from Beijing is David Rennie, the Beijing bureau chief and author of the Chaguan column at The Economist. David, glad to have you with us.
Hello.
I butchered that word, didn't I?
That was pretty good.
How do you say it?
Chaguan.
Chaguan. Chaguan. Yeah. All right. See, I've already learned something in the new year. Chaguan.
It means tea house.
Tea house?
Yeah, that's what it means. Tea house.
Why is your column called Tea House? We'll get to the news in a second, but I have to know the answer to this.
Because it's a place where the Chinese have gathered to exchange ideas and debate for centuries.
I love that. I love that idea. Well, we will carry forth the spirit of Chaguan today in the roundup because we have a lot to talk about. But among other things, we promise to make time to explain what the president meant by this.
India is there. Russia is there. Russia used to be the Soviet Union. Afghanistan made it Russia.
We'll explain that, and we'll make plenty of time for your thoughts and questions about what happened around the world this week. Let's start off with the global economy. It's gotten off to a somewhat shaky start early this year. Wall Street took a hit after Apple reported that the Chinese are buying fewer iPhones. That bolsters concerns that the world's second biggest economy might be fading. Apple CEO Tim Cook was candid about the company's recent performance in the world's largest smartphone market. Here's part of what he said this week to CNBC.
Our shortfall is over 100% from iPhone, and it's primarily in Greater China. It's clear that the economy began to slow there for the second half. And what I believe to be the case is the trade tensions between the United States and China put additional pressure on their economy.
That's Apple CEO Tim Cook speaking on CNBC. And just by way of context, lest we give the impression that Wall Street is tanking as a result of this, the markets opened up today on other economic news, including the unemployment report that showed that more people are entering the workforce. Unemployment's up very slightly, but more people are getting jobs. So just by way of context. David Rennie, this has, however, been big news in the U.S. this week. How is that story about Apple playing in China?
It's really interesting. So here it's an economic story, but it's also, as so often, a story about nationalism. So you're seeing some of the Chinese state media at the more nationalist end saying, this has got nothing to do with trade wars. This is because Apple smartphones just aren't very good. And Chinese consumers are savvy and they want to buy fantastic Chinese smartphones made by firms like Huawei. And of course, that's not just any company. That's the company that America accuses of basically being an arm of Chinese espionage. So very quickly, you get straight from kind of an economic business story into that really strong sense at the moment of these two kind of not quite Cold War kind of powers, but this nationalist confrontation, and it's turning right into a row about that, even with smartphones.
This is also, David, connected to the larger issue, or maybe I should ask you if you see it as connected to the larger issues in tech with regards to things like intellectual property and some of the hoops that American companies have to jump through to do business in a market that they desperately want.
So seen from Beijing, Apple is actually not necessarily the kind of blazing white knight that it plays in the United States. Actually, Apple has collaborated with the Chinese in helping them censor, you know, various websites and apps and proxies that the Chinese consumers might want to stick onto their iPhones to help them see an uncensored internet. Apple has actually collaborated with the Chinese in helping them do that. And you meet some smart, savvy kind of urban Chinese who resent Apple for playing that role. I think the other thing that's fascinating about this iPhone story is it goes to the heart of why I think a lot of people worry that Donald Trump misunderstands the leverage that he has with his ability to put tariffs on goods made in China. And I remember interviewing Donald Trump way back, you know, 2015, I think it was, the first time I interviewed him. And he was talking about how Apple should make its iPhones in America and he would have the power to stick tariffs on Apple's, you know, iPhones made in China. And I said then, but are you sure that that's where the leverage lies? Because actually China isn't just where Apple makes iPhones. They need to sell iPhones in China to do well as a business. And he just kind of brushed that aside as an irrelevance. But you see that actually Donald Trump is realizing these things go two ways.
Let me come back to our panel here in D.C. Indira Lakshmanan, I wonder how much we should read into the connection between China's economy and the rest of the world's economy. I assume it does not mean that if China sniffles, the world catches a cold, but it's a gigantic economy and everything is so interconnected now. What does this mean for the rest of the world's economy?
It is a huge economy, and there's something to that sniffling and catching a cold insofar as you say, the markets are back up today. You know, there has been market uncertainty, but there are a number of economists who look at what's been happening in the last couple of weeks in the markets and say that investors are wary of the contraction that we're seeing in Chinese manufacturing. And so there was a private survey of China's manufacturing sector that showed the first contraction in China in 19 months in December. So with the Chinese economy, particularly the manufacturing sector, specifically in contraction, we have the People's Bank of China now slashing the amount of money that banks are required to hold in reserve. There have been a number of policy changes that the government is trying to take to, you know, pump up growth once again. I think, you know, we do see a downturn in the market. I mean, David is closer to it on the ground there, but certainly on this side of the Pacific, you know, we're hearing investors and economists on Wall Street saying that the pressure from this trade war has actually hit both sides now, and that if there's any moment to strike a trade deal, it might be now, because, you know, not only are Chinese farmers feeling it with the sorghum and the soy and U.S. farmers, but we are finally feeling it now at a larger level with Apple's earnings warning and this drop in U.S. manufacturing happening in China. So I think there could be some progress in trade negotiations. There are supposed to be formal talks going on next week.
And we should be clear, just by way of Apple and the iPhone is Apple's product. Like, far and away, iPhone is the number one product that Apple sells, way more than PCs, and has been for years now. So Apple is basically not just saying the iPhone is down in China, the Apple is saying Apple is down in China. Like, that's kind of the scope of it. If you read any of their earnings reports, just look at how many iPhones they sell compared to, say, Macs or Apple Watches. From a policy perspective, though, Christian, what does this mean? I mean, is there anything that the other world players, the leading markets can do with regards to China if this bodes ill for them, or does China kind of run the table now?
Well, I'm not sure that China runs the table. I'd be curious to hear David weigh in on this. It's quite understandable that we look at this through the prism of Apple and our own economy and the trade war. I think we tend to forget that China is also a gigantic trading partner for the European Union. Nobody ever talks about the European Union in this town. It's just like we forget it exists. Mm-hmm. It's actually, you know, David, I'd be curious to hear your take, but the European Union, if you take it as an entity, I think it's still number three, perhaps, or number two. I don't remember exactly where it stands in the ranking. But China is also incredibly closely integrated with all the other gigantic economies of Asia that we also tend to like to forget. So I think the Chinese relationship with the United States has certainly contributed a lot to this sense of consumer uncertainty in China. But we should also point out that there are a lot of very profound weaknesses within the Chinese economy that don't have very much to do with us or any outsiders. I mean, they've had an amazing performance over the past four decades. But there's nothing that says that they're destined to continue that. They have some very smart policymakers, but the question is, can they really sustain the kind of performance that they have for the past four decades? And I'm not sure that's a decision. That's an issue that depends entirely on what we do.
David, let me let you jump back in.
So if you're an American listener to this show and you're thinking, well, you know, Donald Trump is putting the squeeze on China. China is now slowing down. What's not to like? Well, you know, it's complicated because, as your other panelists have said, this is a global economy. So after the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, gigantic stimulus measures basically kept the Chinese economy afloat. And in doing so, they kept a lot of global companies afloat. I mean, General Motors sells more cars in China than they do in the U.S. This year, 2018, the numbers just came through. It was the first year that Chinese car sales had fallen since 1990. So if you are General Motors, or your Volkswagen, which makes about half its profits in China worldwide, you look at those numbers and you see Chinese consumers tightening belts and generally getting nervous. That affects the whole world. There's a ton of jobs in America, whether you're making planes for Boeing, whether you're a soybean farmer in Iowa, whether you work for General Motors and you're looking at your share price kept afloat by Chinese car sales, or whether you work for Apple. You know, there's a whole bunch of Americans who actually don't want China to fall off a cliff.
Yeah. Yeah. Much more we want to discuss besides China, but let's close the loop on this and then we'll keep moving. Joe emailed, "No one on your panel has made any mention of the fact that a weakening China economy will bring them to a negotiating position regarding technology transfer, trade deficit, and other issues that President Trump is working to resolve." Indira, what do you make of that?
Well, that is actually what I was saying earlier, in fact, that because China is feeling the effects of the tariffs and the U.S. is, both sides are feeling the effects, that in fact, I do think there's an opportunity for striking a deal. As I said before, there are supposed to be talks this coming week. They have, both sides have set this March deadline. For the time being, they've agreed not to impose further tariffs on one another. But I think, you know, U.S. officials I've talked to have seen signs of progress in the trade negotiations. And the weaker Chinese economy, I think, is part of that, is part of the catalyst for that happening.
David, let's hit a few more things out of China before we keep moving. The president of China, Xi Jinping, urged the people of Taiwan to accept that Taiwan, in his words, must and will be reunited with China. President Xi said that this week. Give us a sense of where that stands and why that matters.
Well, President Xi Jinping has made a big thing of being a sort of much more assertive nationalist leader. He recently removed any term limits on his ability to stay as president. So he could be the ruler of China for the whole of his life. So the Taiwanese, remember, a democratic, pro-American island that has never been ruled by communist China, and that China regards as a kind of breakaway province that must be reunited, President Xi, people are very worried that maybe he could, you know, set a deadline by which Taiwan has to return. So if you're a glass half full person, you look at the speech that he just gave and you say, well, the good news is he didn't set an actual deadline for taking back Taiwan. But there was some much tougher language. And one of the big problems is that the current government in Taiwan is from the party that basically is much more wary of links with China. And the Chinese government is determined to strangle them economically, politically, and diplomatically to try and teach the Taiwanese public that voting for that party is a big mistake. And so you see this kind of real pressure on that island of Taiwan. And then into that, I know we keep mentioning Donald Trump, but he comes into this. The Chinese are very jumpy about the Trump administration, not so much Donald Trump,
right,
but some of the people around him who are seen as very pro-Taiwan. They're constantly watching for signs that America might break with the status quo, sell them some more arms or give them some more status. The truth is Donald Trump probably doesn't care about Taiwan very much, particularly he doesn't care very much that it's a democracy. So it may be that the situation is a little bit more stable than people fear.
Indira, right quick?
A couple quick points. Just as Donald Trump was taking office, so try to think back to 2 years ago, he did make some strong statements supporting Taiwan and Taiwan independence and sort of said, now, remind me, why is it that we have this policy where we're not acknowledging that Taiwan is independent?
So didn't he take that call from Taiwan early on?
That was his very first international call.
Yeah.
And so there were a lot of people in Taiwan who thought, oh, my goodness, Donald Trump is going to be a great president for us because he recognizes that we truly are. And let's face it, de facto, I mean, they have been for 40 years a completely independent country. I do want to say that a couple important points about Xi Jinping's speech. You know, his last year's speech, where he talked about the 40 years since this key policy document that opened the door for rapprochement between Beijing and Taipei, he was a lot harsher in that, where he basically said, we will, it's inevitable, we will take over, we will not cede a single inch of land. This time, I'm not saying that he was gentler, but he was saying this time, oh, well, you know, it's inevitable, it's going to happen. And he tried to point out Hong Kong as one country, two systems as a model. Now, I was based in Hong Kong as a correspondent for 7 years and starting from 6 months before the Hong Kong handover. And I can tell you that not only have there been a lot of problems with the handover in terms of not getting the democratic rights that the people feel they were promised, but Taiwanese look at that model and say, that's not the model we want.
Right.
You know, we don't want to be under Beijing's thumb like that. So even though he's holding that out as an alternative, I would definitely say that Taiwanese people, including the president herself, who, let's not forget, was forced to step down in November because of that defeat at the polls, which she now is linking to potential Chinese intervention and interference in the Taiwanese election. I don't think a lot of Taiwanese people are thrilled about the idea of one country, two systems.
Let's move on from China. We'll come back to that a little bit later in the program. Let's shift gears now from China to North Korea and the televised New Year's address from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The dictator appealed for more foreign investment. He said that the plans to denuclearize will not happen if the U.S. maintains sanctions against North Korea. President Trump said progress is being made. He praised President Kim and how the story was reported on here in the United States, including on one network that's particularly close to our hearts.
I was watching PBS and they really covered it accurately. They said that in Chairman Kim's speech, he really wants to get together. He wants to denuclearize. They covered it very, very nicely. I was surprised based on everything I've heard about him. I'll have to start watching PBS much more.
Wow, that's okay.
Shout out to maybe public television and public radio will get more money.
Truly
from
a
the
service
government. Who
for
knows,
all the. Did I mention
barely
that you
get any?
Did I mention that you can follow and support your local PBS member station by going to pbs.org? Because you can. It's at pbs.org. So Christian, safe to say all of our lives would be better if we watched a little more PBS. But let's be serious about the North Korea story. Kim Jong Un says if you push us on sanctions, denuclearization won't happen. Is that a real threat? North Korea said a lot of things in the past that ended up being very flimsy when it came down to rubber hitting road.
Well, you have to be very careful with what they say. They've said all kinds of things in the past. I completely agree with your statement. I think one of the interesting things about his New Year's address was that he once again, people have tried to parse it differently, but he did say that he envisions denuclearization as denuclearization of the entire Korean Peninsula, which is basically North Korean code for, yeah, we'll give up our nukes when the Americans have pulled out and completely effectively ended their relationship with South Korea, and we'll be able to extend our system to the entire peninsula. Then, of course, we may not need nuclear weapons the same way we do now, because we won't need to deter those scary Americans anymore. And I think it's very important to keep that context in mind. He and President Trump clearly have developed some kind of relationship. They clearly have a common set of reasons for wanting to organize this summit in the next few weeks or months, whenever it actually happens. But I think we have to remain very, very skeptical about the prospects of genuine denuclearization in Korea. It's we still haven't seen the president really insist on clear conditions. His previous summit was basically an exchange of nice words and, you know, some very admirable sentiments. But there's really very little concrete meat. You know, there's very little meat in this whole process.
David Rennie, what about what's been happening with denuclearization closer to North Korea? We've heard more about developments between North and South Korea lately, including some concrete developments. We're not worried about, we haven't heard much about seeing rockets flying over the Sea of Japan lately. China obviously has a gigantic stake in what happens in North Korea. Is that kind of where most of the action has been happening these days, more locally than kind of across the Pacific?
So let me break this down. A couple of points. I think one thing that is very worrying is, as Christian says, that, you know, the North Koreans are basically, they've lied through their teeth again and again and again. And I think one thing that's very worrying to allies like the South Koreans or the Japanese here in Asia is, if you ask the Americans, what's different about this time? Why should we think that we should take these talks more seriously? The American answer, starting with President Trump, is you should take it seriously this time because the different thing is that President Trump is president and he is a uniquely intimidating and persuasive man. And that's what's changed everything. Well, the problem with that argument is that that then means that Trump's prestige is at stake. So if you then have evidence that North Korea isn't actually doing what it said or that it's backsliding or it's lying, President Trump and his team take that as an attack on the president's credibility, and you see them immediately circling the wagons. And if you have this weird phenomenon of Donald Trump and his team defending the North Koreans, because an attack on the North Koreans' behavior is a kind of an attack on Donald Trump's negotiating prowess. That's a very, very dangerous dynamic. Finally, on the Chinese side, the Chinese, you know, they don't celebrate Christmas, but they might as well, because this North Korean deal for them is exactly what they've always wanted. The Chinese have for years said, here's a deal that you should do. You should do a freeze for a freeze, where the North Koreans freeze their tests of missiles, their nuclear tests, and the Americans freeze their very provocative military exercises with the South Koreans. And every other president before President Trump, Democrat and Republican, always said, that's outrageous. Our exercises with South Korea are completely legitimate. There's nothing wrong with them. North Korea's nuclear activities, the opposite, illegal and illegitimate. So how dare you put them in the same basket and expect a deal of a freeze for freeze?
Right.
Donald Trump has taken that Chinese offer of a freeze for a freeze and made it his policy.
Let's step away from China and North Korea and come back closer to the U.S. to Brazil, where its new president, Jair Bolsonaro, was sworn in this week. He waved to crowds from an open-topped Rolls-Royce in the streets of Brasilia. The far-right politician promised to liberate Brazil from what he called socialism, inverted values, the bloated state, and political correctness. Now, last year when we covered this story, we spoke to reporter Brian Winter from America's Quarterly. Here's part of what he told us speaking from Sao Paulo.
I've had meetings with people from civil society and the press and others who, you know, these are serious people, not prone to panic or anything like that, who are talking openly about the possibility of exile. And this just blew me away. I mean, it's a Brazil that I've read about in history books, you know, going back to previous periods of military rule. 1964 was the last coup. I thought that that was a Brazil that had been firmly relegated to the history books. And, you know, maybe they are, maybe it is getting a little bit melodramatic in some quarters, but there are real fears and people are scared right now.
That was Brian Winter of America's Quarterly speaking to us from Sao Paulo late last year. Now, Indira, President Trump tweeted his congratulations to President Bolsonaro on the day he was sworn in. He wrote, quote, "The USA is with you," unquote. I wonder how this is shaping up, whether some of these real fears that Brian spoke of are beginning to materialize or whether it's too soon to know.
No. I mean, Bolsonaro has gotten straight to work, and he's already issued a directive that gives the agriculture ministry, which remember, Brazil is the largest country in all of South America. It's vast, and the country is really dominated from a financial point of view by this agro-business lobby, and he's given the agriculture ministry control over areas that were reserved for Brazil's indigenous people, so some of the last tribes in the Amazon and descendants of former slaves. He's also said that it's going to be almost impossible for new protected lands to be marked in the Amazon. I just want to point out that a Pulitzer Center project from a couple of months ago on PBS NewsHour by Sam Eaton found and showed how the Amazon now, because of so much clear cutting and logging, is becoming no longer a carbon sink where you would suck in greenhouse gases, but is actually now emitting greenhouse gases. And Bolsonaro has been a climate denier. He has basically said he's going to open the floodgates for more development in the Amazon. A government agency run by a prominent general was given the ability to monitor international organizations, whatever that means. The LGBT community has been excluded from this new human rights ministry. So he has already taken a lot of action. And don't forget, Bolsonaro was essentially a bit of a fringe joke politician until he suddenly came to power because people were frustrated with the government and the guy who was running from the ruling party. But he has expressed real support for the military dictatorship that ruled Brazil for 21 years until 1985. And a whole bunch of his supporters in the parliament, you know, the lawmakers greeted him on Tuesday with this sign of a gun, you know, pointing at him, which was sort of their salute. In other words, hard line, crackdown, in much the same way that we saw in the Philippines with Duterte, who Donald Trump has also praised.
Although it's worth noting, Christian, none of this comes as a surprise. Like, this is the Jair Bolsonaro that we knew, and he's kind of turning out to be the guy we thought he was.
Well, I also wanted to make the point, everything that Indira said just now is absolutely true. It's really very disturbing indeed. But we have to remember that he's not coming out of a vacuum. Just as Trump's rise took a lot of people, me, you know, among them, completely by surprise, we have to be realistic about the environment that has produced him. You know, the previous socialist party that was in power for years and years and years drove the country into a dead end. They've been going through one of the most massive corruption scandals in recent memory, perhaps in the world, I would say, much of which was due to the previous party being in power so long. The economy, which was one of
But that's different, not a parallel to the U.S. case, of course.
Well, of course. But I'm just saying, you know, we got to remember what happened and why voted for this really very marginal and strange candidate.
People were sick of the Workers' Party.
People were sick of the Workers' Party. Brazil went in a very short period from being one of the world's absolute leading economic performers to being an also-ran, just an absolute unparalleled economic disaster. And that's really where this guy's coming from, and those are the things that he's responding to. So by all justified criticism, we need to at least keep that in mind.
David, I know we have to pause in just a moment, but with regards to Brazil, it's worth noting that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in talks with the new Brazilian regime about what to do with Venezuela. And Pompeo calls the alliance with Brazil, in his words, a joint effort against authoritarian regimes, unquote, in Latin America. Where might this alliance be heading? An alliance of convenience, of shared values? How do you see that, before we pause?
Oh, there's something real in there. I mean, America still does have serious concerns about the regimes in not just Venezuela, but also in Cuba, obviously, and Nicaragua, where you have left-wing dictatorships committing genuine, horrible human rights abuses. And America is in search of like-minded allies willing to put much more pressure on the Venezuelans in particular. And it should be said that the former left-wing government in Brazil, although it was a democratic government, was worryingly tolerant of the human rights abuses in Venezuela. That's clearly changed. And America does have much more of an ally in Bolsonaro when it comes to putting pressure and sanctions on the Venezuelan regime. Then that begs the question about what is America's plan after the Venezuelan regime collapses? And there you have doubts, I think, in the whole region. I was there with Vice President Mike Pence, about a year ago in my old job as Washington bureau chief. The region doesn't really trust the Trump administration to have a plan for Latin America, but it's in the mix with Brazil now.
Much more to discuss in a moment with David Rennie of The Economist, Christian Carl of The Washington Post, and Indira Lakshmanan of the Pulitzer Center. Still to come, it was a big week for space exploration. We'll talk about an icy mystery at the edge of the solar system and some new exploration on the far side of the moon. Not the dark side of the moon. The far side of the moon. We'll explain in a minute. Stay close.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup. Let's talk about an interesting story from Russia involving a former Marine and a British citizen. Paul Whelan was taken into custody by Russian authorities last Friday in Moscow. Russia indicted him yesterday and charged him with espionage. If he's convicted, he could serve up to 20 years in prison. Christian Carl, who is Paul Whelan? What do we know about this guy?
Well, you described him as a British citizen. He is, of course, also an American citizen, which is why he was visited in prison by the U.S. ambassador a few days ago. He is, as you said, a former Marine. He did two deployments in Iraq, was discharged from the Marine Corps for theft, apparently. And he appears to be a really, really huge Russia fan. He was actually a member of a Russian social network called Vkontakte, which I know quite well, but which is actually used almost exclusively by Russians. I don't think there are many non-Russians who use it. And he's spent the past few years traveling back and forth to Russia, apparently not in connection with his work. He is the security chief for a car parts company in the United States. Not exactly good cover for a spy. And in fact, when you look at him closely, he's absolutely does not fit the pattern of people that we've used in the past for spying in Russia. I mean, I can hardly second guess the CIA, but he would have been a very odd choice to work as an American spy. And I've actually known people who were detained in Moscow and expelled as spies and who, in fact, worked for the CIA. He's just so far out of this pattern at all, it's really hard to believe the charges that the Russians are attributing to him. And, of course, we think that there is, in fact, a political reason why they've decided to detain him.
Yeah, David, what do you make of these charges? It's worth noting that, you know, there have been some Russian figures, including Maria Butina, who last month pled guilty to acting as a foreign agent against the U.S. Might this be kind of an attempt to create some leverage to try to get Maria Butina back in exchange for this guy? Or what is this?
So what do we know? We know that going back to Soviet days, the KGB was extremely good at finding kind of random Westerners when they wanted to do a spy swap and planting evidence on them. And we do know that this guy, who, as Carol says, is more Johnny English than James Bond, was
let's not insult Johnny English.
I was about to say, wow, really, David Rennie?
Was detained after being handed what they say was a USB stick containing the names of employees at a secret security agency in Russia. that is incredibly standard behavior by Russian intelligence going back decades. They then, you know, they lock you up and they swap you. So I don't think there's any question that the Russian state is not capable of doing this. And if Russian prosecutors are lining him up, there's also no question that Russian prosecutors take their orders directly from the top. So I think I wouldn't want to be this guy. And I think Carl is right that the CIA, you hope, have people who are better to recruit than this guy.
Indira?
Well, I was just going to say a little more background on him. He is American-born. He was a staff sergeant in the Marines. He did serve, as Christian said, two tours in Iraq in 2004-2006. But in 2008, he got a bad conduct discharge from the U.S. military and was demoted to the rank of private over some larceny charges, according to records. And he now is the director of global security at this American auto parts supply. You know, whether he's been set up as retaliation for the arrest of Maria Butina, which, by the way, let's not forget, the Russians have said, you know, she's not a spy. Are you kidding? She's not a spy for us. And at the same time, official accounts of the Russian government on social media have come out hugely in defense of her, even though they claim, of course, she's not a spy. She's just a private citizen. What was interesting was Paul Whelan's Russian lawyer, a guy called Vladimir Zhirabenkov, if I'm pronouncing his name right, has, you know, unsolicited in an interview with ABC News, brought up the idea that there might be a prisoner, a spy swap. So even though he's saying that his client is not a spy, he's outright saying that because this charge would carry 10 to 20 years, that he expects that the Russians want a swap for Butina or whoever else.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to have a defense lawyer like that personally.
No, no,
he's
no.
Already, selling me down the river when he's supposedly defending me.
Well, we may not know what's going to happen with this guy. We may not know this guy's future, but there is something related to the past, to history, that came up this week in the news regarding President Trump. It's a comment that he made. If you missed it, here is some of what the president said that raised so many eyebrows.
Russia used to be the Soviet Union. Afghanistan made it Russia because they went bankrupt fighting in Afghanistan. Russia. So you take a look at other countries. Pakistan is there. They should be fighting. But Russia should be fighting. The reason Russia was in Afghanistan was because terrorists were going into Russia. They were right to be there.
Part of what President Trump said this week. Indira, you raised your hand first.
Well, okay, there's so much to take apart and analyze here, but let me just say that I think the kernel of what President Trump was trying to get at, if we can try to pick out one thing he's trying to say where he's making some coherent sense here, is he's trying to make the analogy to Afghanistan as the graveyard of empires. And that's an argument that has been made for a very long time, that Afghanistan brought down the British Empire because they got mired down there. That, you know, Afghanistan was difficult for the Soviets. But to say
or that America has been fighting since 9/11 and has no exit strategy.
Right, correct. And that's been, you know, it's been 18
years.
Going
on 18 years, yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's all fine. But it's absolutely historically false that the reason the Soviet Union went into Afghanistan is because of terrorists coming over the border. There have been declassified former Soviet documents that have come out, that have been written about, State Department history that has just come out in the last few weeks, which shows without a shadow of a doubt that the reason the Soviet Union went in is because it was worried about great power. You know, it was a proxy war. In the same way that the Soviets were in Cuba and we didn't like that, they didn't like that the United States was in there training Mujahideen, that the CIA was training Mujahideen like Osama bin Laden, let's not forget, in that era. And so they went in because they were trying to protect their interests. You know, it may be that, you know, it was a costly war for them, but that was certainly not the reason for the fall of the Soviet Union. And it certainly not got anything to do with terrorists crossing the border.
David Rennie, in the scheme of things, how much of an impact do you think that President Trump's comment about Russia and Afghanistan really has? I mean, is this the kind of thing that is liable to move policy or shake opinions, or is this just something else inaccurate that he said? Is this a big deal?
I think it is a big deal. I think it's a big deal domestically, because I think that one of the interesting things, any Republican president was going to have to reckon with the fact that the Republican base includes a lot of people whose sons and daughters fought and died in these wars. And remember, before Donald Trump turned up, if you were a Republican and you said that they had died in vain, you would have been howled down as saying that their sacrifice was in vain. You would have been you know, drummed out of the Republican Party. Donald Trump's brilliant insight, I would say malevolent insight, was to tell them a story, a kind of isolationist story, where he said to those same families, your sons and daughters were too good for this world. This is a nasty, brutish world. We shouldn't be trying to make it any better. America shouldn't be trying to defend any values at all. And you died because Americans are too good for this world and too generous, and we need to be nastier and more selfish. And you remember that thing where we should have gone and taken the oil. That was his kind of foreign policy. How does this tie into geopolitics? Here I am sitting in Beijing. It's another data point. The Chinese government looks at this American president and they hear something they have never heard from any other American president. They have heard, you know, American presidents over the years saying the Cold War was a fight between good and evil. Remember, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was Exhibit A in Ronald Reagan's case that the Soviet Union was an evil empire.
Right.
That their behavior in Afghanistan was wicked and we were the good guys. The Chinese now see an American president saying, screw that. There are no good guys. There are no bad guys. This is about interest. This is about American interests, and we're out of there. If you're sitting in Beijing, you're thinking, oh my goodness, history has just handed us the biggest opportunity we've ever had, which is an American president who doesn't believe in America, who doesn't think that America is better than us. And that's an extraordinary opportunity for a geopolitical rising power like China.
A few more stories we'd like to get to before our time is up. One of them involving South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. On Sunday, he abruptly recanted his criticism of President Trump's decision to withdraw troops from Syria. The senator spoke to the president and then spoke to reporters just a few minutes thereafter. Here's part of what he said.
We had a great lunch. We talked about Syria, and he told me some things I didn't know that make me feel a lot better about where we're headed in Syria. He promised to destroy ISIS. He's going to keep that promise. We're not there yet. But as I said today, we're inside the 10-yard line, and the president understands the need to finish the job.
That was South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham speaking this week after meeting with the president. Now, previously, Senator Graham had called the troop withdrawal in Syria, in his words, an Obama-like mistake, and said that the president's claim about the Islamic State being defeated, Senator Graham referred to it as, in his words, fake news. Christian, what do we think caused Senator Graham to change his mind on this?
I don't know. I'd really like to know what was in that lunch that they were having. I'd like to have some of that stuff, too, I think.
Or would you?
Or would I? Yeah. Maybe not. Certainly not as a working journalist.
Well, and particularly because Senator Graham was very strident about, and he's not the only one. There were senators on both sides of the aisle saying, you know, the damage does not mean defeated. And if we pull out now, we could do worse by pulling out early than by finishing the job, as we say.
And it was one of the reasons that the defense secretary resigned.
Right. Why Jim Mattis left.
Well, I mean, one of the most striking things about this whole episode with Graham is that, you know, one of the things he said that the president reassured him about was that we would not leave Iran to its own devices in Syria. And Graham said, wow, see, so I misunderstood everything. We're not going to leave everything open to Iran. And then a little while later, Trump said, well, actually, I think we are.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's just extraordinary how you can never pin this president down on anything. You may go into a meeting with him and he may sit there and agree with you completely, and then you'll come out and he'll say 180 degrees the opposite.
Indira?
And Trump also added later that Syria is nothing but sand and death. That was his quote. It's not worth American lives. It goes to the point that David was making really well, that the brilliance of Trump in his sort of America first foreign policy, brilliance towards his base, I should say, is in painting it as it's a bad, bad Hobbesian world out there, and there's no point in us getting involved. Syria's just sand and death. So why are we wasting our time?
Let me stick with you, Indira, for another story that caught our attention. Netflix pulled an episode of Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj this week. We've interviewed Hasan Minhaj on this program about the show, because they pulled the episode in Saudi Arabia at the request of the Saudi government. The episode was about Saudi Arabia. And Minhaj blasted the kingdom over the Yemen civil war and the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Here is part of that episode of Patriot Act.
Just a few months ago, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, a.k.a. MBS, was hailed as the reformer the Arab world needed. But the revelations about Khashoggi's killing have shattered that image. And it blows my mind that it took the killing of a Washington Post journalist for everyone to go, oh, I guess he's really not a reformer. Meanwhile, every Muslim person you know was like, yeah, no, he's the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. So now would be a good time to reassess our relationship with Saudi Arabia. And I mean that as a Muslim and as an American.
That's from the episode of Patriot Act with Hassan Minhaj that was pulled from Netflix in Saudi Arabia. Now, Minhaj tweeted this week, quote, "Clearly the best way to stop people from watching something is to ban it, make it trend online, and then leave it up on YouTube," unquote. Now, Indira, I think he has a point, and also this goes to the fact that you and I have talked about press freedom and media freedom around the world. Netflix pulling something from Saudi Arabia is kind of part and parcel with what a number of world governments have demanded from objectionable content. But this kind of takes the U.S.-Saudi thing down a different path.
First of all, I'm disappointed in Netflix for doing this, but I haven't talked to their legal department, and I assume that there was enough of a grounds under Saudi Arabia's Cyber Security Act or whatever it is, in which they said this is a threat to the kingdom and you must take it down. And I guess Netflix figured they couldn't win that case. But the truth of the matter is, as Hassan Minhaj said, they left it up on YouTube. It's now got 1.6 million views and counting. I urge everyone to go onto Netflix or YouTube and watch the episode if you haven't seen it. It's great. And one of the other things he says in there, he refers to an old sore point. He refers to Saudi Arabia as the boy band of 9/11. And if you remember, the vast majority of those 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. And I'm sure many people remember the redacted pages that came out in the 9/11 report, where we don't know everything that was investigated into Saudi Arabian high officials and leaders' potential knowledge of and support for terrorists.
Before we wrap up, we should look up to space, where two big stories hit the news this week. Space exploration history was made when China successfully landed a vehicle on the far side of the moon. There's a 300-pound rover that is now roving and sending pictures back to Earth. Reaction in China has been somewhat restrained, though. According to the New York Times, the mission did not feature as one of the top four stories on China's top TV news program Thursday evening. In addition to that successful landing, NASA's New Horizons mission sent back photos this week from the most distant place humans have ever explored. On New Year's Day, scientists and engineers celebrated as the New Horizons spacecraft approached an object 4 billion miles from the sun. It's shaped kind of like a snowman. It's called Ultima Thule, meaning beyond the known world. It consists of two connected spheres about 19 miles long. Scientists believe this part of the universe could also be home to some of the solar system's earliest building blocks. And we thank our panel for being part of the star stuff that makes the roundup work. Indira Lakshmanan, executive editor at the Pulitzer Center. Thanks, Indira.
Thanks so much.
David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Thanks, David.
Thanks for having me.
And Christian Carl of The Washington Post and author of Strange Rebels. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you.
Our senior producers are Lindsay Foster Thomas, Danielle Knight, Denise Couture, and Gabe Bullard. Our podcast editor is Miranda Fulmore. You can find out more about them and the rest of our team at the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.